Ben Hulf got real sudden.
Amongst 11 people were prominent people from our hometown, intellectuals, and one of them was a doctor, Dr. Brahms, together with his daughter Anya, whom I knew quite well. She was about a year older than I, and very lively, very intelligent girl, together with her mother. He was a children's doctor and very much a very small man, but very liked by everybody. I mean, the fact that he was working for children by itself doesn't necessarily mean that he had a love for children, but it so happens that it happened to be both. Well, this happened in March, and for the next 3 months, this continuous erosion of confidence and destruction carried on. Among the things that happened, and the things that I think it's interesting to tell, is it was a case of my friend's father, who was whom I mentioned about before. I stayed with them the very first day when I arrived, when I came back from the from the glass factory, and his father hid his parents. And then for some reason, it was this, somebody found out that he hid his parents. So he was a policeman. He was a sanitary policeman, and then he was told, very simply, "You either deliver your parents, or else we're going to take your wife and your son and you. So we're giving you 12 hours to make up your mind." Well, he came home, he discussed it with his wife, he went to see his parents, and his parents, and of course the parents said, "Look, we are older people, give us up." Anyway, of course, in the end he delivered his parents. It so happens that he survived together with his wife and my friend. And I've always felt very, very sorry for this man, because whilst I never talked to him about it, whilst nobody probably ever talked to him about it, but I often wondered, how did he feel? How did he live with himself? He knew that he was giving his parents up to certain death. Yet, what options did he have? Now, the crime was not only a crime what the Germans committed against the Jews, against humanity, but it is what even those who have survived, what these people had to live with, how their life was marred afterwards, because they couldn't have possibly have escaped this constant questioning, the conscience of having personally taken knowingly one's parents to death. Yet, who would have acted in a different way? Can anybody accuse him? Well, I never did. I simply sympathized with him. I've met him after the war a few times. They lived in the United States, and he died not so long ago, but whenever I used to see this man, I felt very close to him and very sorry for him, and because I could always think about the way he had to give up his parents to death. Well, I can tell you that he was not the only one who had to make this kind of a decision, because very often there were decisions where a husband had to decide whether he goes together with all his family, or he is going to be left alone, left by himself. Or a wife was left behind, and her husband and all the family went. And you see, and these decisions were not a question of sitting down and thinking about it. This is your choice. It all happened on the spur of the moment, and when it happened, it was too late to do anything about it. The other iniquity that people had to live with after they were liberated, those who did survive, was the situation of a woman who has just lost everybody, and she was completely on her own, helpless, defenseless. And in the first few days, she really was at the point of committing suicide, because she really, to her, life was not worth living. Yet, after a very short time, the conditions were such that when a man who has also lost his family was left on his own, but had some means to look after himself and somebody else, in this case a woman, came to her and said to her, look, let's look after each other, I'll look after you, you'll be with me. Very often these people teamed up with each other. And this happened within a matter of weeks, not months. It all happened during that particular period, just a matter of a few months. I am relating this because it is so important to understand the kind of degradation and the kind of mental anguish that people were subjected to, that they resorted to this kind of situation, that they, on the one hand, they had the pain and the wounds, the open wounds of having just lost their little ones and all their friends, and the next minute, in order to survive, they sought protection from somebody else, and vice versa. Now, can one condemn these people for having done it, unless one has really understood what went on during those days? And then there was the question of religion, the way people turned against religion, and the way people turned towards religion. And there were those who I remember very clearly who before the war were very religious, very pious. They were wearing long beards. They were wearing a kind of garb, dress, sartorial dress that was prevalent in Poland before the war. They had these little peaked hats, and they had the long coats and the big boots, you know, that they used to call them cowboys as a result of it. But suddenly, they had such a grievance against God that they started blaspheming in a way that when I heard it, I found it terrifying. But to them, God has forsaken them, and therefore there was no way that they could, and that they would forgive God for whatever they've done. And yet there were others who, because of what happened to them, whether it was for weakness or for whatever reason, they turned the other way and they started praying when they didn't pray before. So there was no rhyme or reason the way people behaved. There were reactions were different in so many different in so many people. It affected them differently. Anyway, to come back to where I left off, for the next 2 or 3 months, we just went out to work, came back to work, people were disappearing, people were dying, people were being killed. And then by about July 1943, the Germans decided to liquidate the small ghetto, and by so doing, make the place Judenrein, clear of all Jews from my own time. So the decision came to liquidate all the small all the places where there were only a small number of people working. Now, whether there were 40 or 50 people or 60 people working, they decided that they don't want them anymore. And the only people that were going to be left behind were going to be those who worked in a glass factory, where they were going to leave 1,000 people, and in a woodwork factory, where they were going to be also around... No, sorry, the other way around. There were 1,000 people in the woodwork factory and about 700 to 800 people in the two glasswork factories. It was called Hutter, Hortensia and Kara. Now, the place where my father worked, all those were earmarked to be sent away to another place. So when we they ordered us to a central point where they called it the selection place, and they were sent. And some people managed to get over who worked in the smaller places managed to get a few places into the glass factory, some into the woodwork factory, and my father found himself on a lorry together with my sister and my little cousin to be sent away to another camp about 80 or 90 miles away from my hometown. I was in the glass factory, and so because we were told that we all have to be together with the people that we are working with, so there was no question of being with your family or anything. This was the orders. If I went with my father, I would have been beaten up, or somebody would have been beaten up because I wanted to go. I had to be where I was ordered to be, where I was. I was working in the glass factory. My father was working in another place, so he had to be at that place. But with my father was my sister, and because they did not work. When they were already on the lorry, my sister suddenly jumped off from the lorry and ran up to the chief of the Gestapo, and she turned around to him and she said that my brother is inside and he is in the glass factory. Could I join him there? And he was taken aback by this little girl coming up to him, and he looked at her, and she was a very, according to all the reports and comments that we had, she was a very sweet and good-looking girl. And he looked at her and smiled, and he said, "Right, go in." Then she had the strength, the temerity to ask the next question. My father and my sister, she referred to my cousin as a sister, is also on that lorry. Could they come with me? And again he said yes. So my father gets off the lorry, and they came in. Now when they came in, they were allotted to go to work in the woodwork factory. Now, in the meantime, somebody came along to me and said to me, "Look, you know, your father is going to they've allocated your father to be in the woodwork factory." So amongst the people who were there on the selection place was my father's friend, the one who gave me permission to go and work in the glass factory. So I ran up to him and I said to him, "Can you do something to transfer me over that I can be with my father in the woodwork factory?" So he said, "Where is it?" He says, "Okay." So he went, wrote out a note, and I took the note and I went over there, and I found myself together with my father and with my cousin. So we marched outside the town, which is about 3 or 4 kilometers, and we were billeted in the factory. There was a very big this was a very big factory, which was before the war, was a textile factory, which at that stage, this particular building was they removed all the machines, and so instead of the machines, we were billeted there. There were two large floors, and so about 500 of us were on one floor, another 500 on the top floor. Again, the floor was about 3,000 square foot, that would be a lot. So you can imagine 500 people living in 3,000 square foot. The only way we managed to live like this was that we're living on bunks. Two bunks, four high, and we had to share a bunk as well. So this time, however, we lived still in a room. Now there was not even a room; we just lived simply in the bunk. Now we settled down there very quickly in that factory. This was early, sort of late summer now, August, September. And strangely enough, when chief of Gestapo a month later came to visit the camp, one of the people he wanted to see and inquire about was about my sister. And he asked them, where is that little girl that I ordered to come here? And they brought her to him. And he asked her, now, are you happy? Are they looking after you? And if anybody does anything to you, you let me know. And he was really very good to her. It's this sort of reaction was very, very strange. But that is the kind of thing that was happening. They were capable of 1 minute showing mercy and sympathy. On the other hand, they were capable of taking out their gun and just shooting at random whoever they wanted. Well, life in the factory there, on the whole, was bearable. From that moment on, the shooting stopped. There was some, but not with the same intensity and regularity. Now, I didn't work very hard there. I got a job whereby I was sort of filling in always, and they gave me there was a job more with boys rather than with the older one. And I must say, this was the time I was growing up very fast. I was 13, I was 14, getting on towards 14 years old. And I used to spend a lot of time running around in the factory, getting to know everybody, finding out what they're doing and so on. And as long as I wasn't caught, the art was really to pretend that one is working. As long as I was picking something up and carrying something, it meant that I was working. Normally people weren't questioning. Unless I was allocated to do a specific job. When I did allocated to do a specific job, then I had to do it. And I must say, I was very industrious, in spite of the fact that one learned to spare one's energy. I was very serious, and I always accepted every job that I got more as a challenge than anything else. And I, from time to time, I used to be told off by the older people not to be so, not to show such zeal and enthusiasm. But of course, whilst I understood it, what they meant, it was very difficult to control me because I was young and I was growing up, and I tried to express myself, and this was my expression. If I had to do a job, I wanted to show how strong I am and how good I am and so on, and I did it all very well. But by so doing, this is now looking back, I mean, that I can talk about it. At the time, of course, what I was doing was wrong, because if I did my job quickly and well, then I exposed the older people, because they tried to conserve their energy. They always did a lot less. As I said, they only worked very hard when they were watched. But then we weren't watched all the time in that particular place. Only from time to time they would come for inspection, or the guards would come along and so on. And whilst they were there, we pretended we were knocking the wood much harder than we would normally, and there was a big noise and so on. But once they were gone, we settled down. But there was always somebody on the lookout. I used to be very often one of those couriers or the runners who used to sort of, since I was everywhere, I used to notice that somebody's coming. I used to run and quickly pass. There was a special byword that we used to have. And I used to sort of, the word used to pass from mouth to mouth, and everybody was suddenly working very hard. Now, there were two directors there in that factory who were German. One was there because he came from a connected family, especially his wife. His wife came from a landed aristocracy and well connected in the higher ups. She was a very fine woman and a woman of great feeling. And I think that she contributed a lot to the fact that there were times when we, on the whole, had a relatively calm time because of her. Because what happened, this factory was called Dietrich and Fischer. Dietrich was a cruel man. And his wife, unfortunately, was no better than he. Now, the reason why he was in that factory was because he tried, they were all young, they were young people. He wanted to save himself from being sent to the Russian front. They were absolutely, all were frightened for the Russian, to be sent to the Russian front. So, and this is one of the reasons why we were saved in a way, because they created a lot of work pretending that this work was necessary for the war effort. And therefore, by keeping us, they kept themselves there. But one of the two had to go. And Dietrich, who had less influence than Fischer, he was sent away. And that was really a great blessing, because Dietrich was in fact responsible for 13 people being killed in that factory just a few days before we all came there to live there. It was for no reason at all. The Gestapo came along and they said that there was some sabotage. They picked out 13 people, they put them against the wall, and they shot them. Now, there was a great controversy about this. Some people said that it was Dietrich who organized it, and some people said that Dietrich had nothing to do with it, but it was the Gestapo who ordered him to do it. And in fact, there was a trial after the war. Somebody recognized that this Dietrich survived the war, and he was recognized, I think, in Frankfurt. Somebody walked in the street and he recognized him, brought him to justice. There was a trial. The trial went on for a long time, and the trial eventually became inconclusive because there was no way that one can prove that he was directly responsible. Anyway, whatever had happened, he was sent to the Russian front. Fischer remained behind.
Were they Polish?
No, they were German. They were real Germans. I mean, they were well educated young Germans from well-to-do homes and well-connected, as I said. Now, Fischer, when his wife was there, he lived just on the edge of the factory, and also just not far away where the camp was. His wife used to go back to Germany to visit her parents. But whilst she was there, when Fischer always behaved himself to the point of perfection. He would never hit anybody, but especially when he took her for a walk, well, he was on his best behavior. And she really had a lovely face, very sympathetic, and when she came out with him, it was almost like the sun was shining. But he had a dog. The Germans all liked dogs. And this dog was called Ips. And one of the diversions that he used to use with this dog was when he came out of his so-called palace into the factory, he lets the dog out in front of him, and the dog went straight to the lavatories. Now, the lavatories was a place which, when if one really needed to relieve oneself, there was never any place to relieve oneself, because anybody who wanted to have a few minutes break from work, and he wanted to smoke, because one was not allowed to smoke in the factory, because it was wood factory. So anybody who wanted to have a smoke would go into the toilet. So, and people used to stand around there and talk politics and discuss God knows what. So it was always in the toilets. And he was obviously informed about the fact that people are congregating around the toilet. So he used to send the dog straight for the toilet. And that dog was trained to do one thing, to pull the trousers down from the person. Now usually, the distance was such that the majority of people managed to get out in time and to get back to the factory. So it was really a kind of more of a kind of a game rather than anything else. But on one occasion, there was a man who really was in dire trouble and he needed to relieve himself and he just couldn't run out. So the next thing that happened was one could see the dog with this man, the dog pulling the man out, and the man talking to the dog, "Ips, Ips, look, I have paper in my hands. You can see, I needed to relieve myself, he was saying to him, you know, in Yiddish. Let me go, let me go. Ips, let me go, let me go. And of course, the fisher, when he heard it, he was absolutely found it very hilarious. And I must tell you, so did everybody around there, because people were actually working in the open air, because the wood is always stacked in the open, and there was also next to it was a plywood factory as well. The plywood factory was right next to the toilet, and the people outside who were there working, of course, the dog would not touch them. They were listening to this, and they were in such a state of hilarity that Fisher was in a tremendous mood, because it was so funny to watch this man talking to this dog. Later on, we nicknamed this man Ips, let me go. That was how everybody knew him, and I don't even remember now what's the name of this man. And I never remembered then what was the name of this man, other than I knew him and that we referred to him as Ips, let me go. Anyway, these were the things, you know, that used to happen, and that in some cases it sort of added to the sort of to the hilarity of it, or to the fun of it, if one could call it fun. But that's how it was.
Lighter moments.
That's right. The lighter moments. Yes. Now the things that we used to do.
Did your sister and your young cousin have to work as well?
No. Cousin did not work, but my sister, she was going out to work. She was working there as well. And of course, when we came back, it was always we always used to eat together. My father and I lived separately from them, because they lived with the women, we lived with the men. And but we used to go over there, because we used to keep whatever food we used to get, and we used to share it all out together, and we used to eat there.
Was food given out to you?
Well, yes, we had rations, but the point is that there was a lot of smuggling going on. See, we were also working with the Poles, and the Poles we used to buy it off them. And my father worked in the open air, and he with the manager of the, was a Pole, and my father, and together with another friend of my father, who incidentally is alive, and he is here in England. The man is now about 72 years old. The two of them were smuggling together. They were partners. Whenever, from time to time, we see each other quite often, and I feel very close to him because of the connection with my father. And occasionally we laugh about it, because he called it that he and my father were partners in crime, because they were smuggling in food into they worked together, and they were smuggling into this spaghetti. So on the whole, we did not lack any food. We were not short of food. The majority of people weren't short of any food in this place. And I certainly wasn't short of anything. So I made it